You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Electric Boogaloo, a market is springing up for tricked-out conversions of vintage vehicles as the motor industry shifts gears, by Brett Burke. In the photos, a 1954 Volkswagen bus by Kindred Motorworks, $199,000. 1960 Volkswagen Beetle by Zelectric Motors from $118,000. 1969 Porsche 912 Coupe, also by Zelectric, from $195,000. 1985 Land Rover Defender 110 by ECD Automotive Design from $280,000. And 1947 Chevrolet 3100 pickup, also by Kindred, $159,000. For years, Rob Howard restored old cars. In his youth, he worked on a 1971 Plymouth Duster with his dad, and as an adult, he restored 1960s Mustangs and modernized a 1957 Chevy station wagon so he could drive it safely with his kids. But the cars weren't dependable, and it was especially difficult to tune antiquated fuel systems. No matter what, it always smelled like gasoline, he says. With a background in tech and engineering, Howard sought improved outcomes. His key determination? Banish petroleum. When you think about restoring your car, electrification is so obvious, he says. It performs better, it's lower maintenance, and it's actually a roughly equivalent cost. In 2019, 2 years after he'd sold his software company to Target and worked on the executive team there, he decided to apply his skills in software, supply chain management, and retail to a new business of old car electrification, founding Kindred Motorworks in San Rafael, California. Today, his 40-person team has multi-year contracts with electric vehicle battery, motor, and parts suppliers, allowing them to rehab vintage Ford Broncos, Volkswagen buses, and Chevy trucks, and convert them to EVs that cost anywhere from $149,000 to $199,000. In a new 110,000-square-foot facility in the Napa Valley, Howard plans to electrify thousands of vehicles and introduce several new old models each year. There are 30 million collectible cars in the U.S., he says, so it's a very large opportunity. Soon and McKeel Haggerty, whose namesake company is one of the world's largest insurers of classic vehicles, and Robert Downey Jr.'s environmentally oriented venture capital firm, Footprint Coalition, are investors. Kindred isn't alone. Zelectric, also in California, focuses on VW Beetles and Porsches that it goes on to sell from $100,000 to $300,000. The Ghost Garage in Michigan does Jeep Grand Wagoneers, $295,000. ECD in Florida electrifies classic Land Rover Defenders, Range Rovers, and Jaguar E-Types, $225,000 to more than $400,000. Other companies focus on providing conversion hardware for DIYers and small shops. Michael Brim, founder of EV West, leads this realm. Since 2009, Brim has been designing and retailing bolt-in electrification kits for vintage Porsches and VWs, becoming a soft power evangelist for alternative energy. You can have some old man who doesn't give a shit about the environment, but he's actually being environmental because we sold him an electric car based on horsepower and fun to drive, Brim says. And after he drives it for 6 months, He comes to the shop and he's like, "Hey man, I got solar put on the roof." Even Ford and General Motors are entering the category, building electric motors sized to replace their guzzly old V8 engines. Classic vehicle restoration is an integral part of GM's business and history, wrote Travis Hester, GM's Vice President of EV Growth Operations. Extending that same passion to electrification is a natural next step. Because the collector market privileges unmodified vehicles, there was an early emphasis on preserving removed gas engines so they could be reinstalled should the owners later resell. But as the practice has caught on, this has shifted and EV-converted cars have become eminently desirable. Ewan McGregor came down here with his 1954 oval window VW Beetle, just a beautiful showpiece, and he had a matching numbers engine in it, and when we pulled it out, he said, "I want to save that motor," Brim says. But a year after McGregor picked up his electrified bug, he hadn't retrieved the gas engine. Brim messaged him, wanting to know where to send it. McGregor wrote back, "Oh, mate, I don't want that." writer's block, journalists see artificial intelligence bots like ChatGPT as a potential threat and an opportunity, by Joe Pompeo. Opening illustration by Nicolas Ortega, which shows an inkwell that looks like a robot head with a quill pen about to be dipped in. Nick Cave, in his idiosyncratic fan correspondence newsletter, recently critiqued a song in the style of Nick Cave, created using ChatGPT. At a glance, the lyrics evoked the dark religious overtones that run through Cave's oeuvre. Upon closer inspection, this ersatz Cave track was a low-rent simulacrum. I understand that ChatGPT is in its infancy, but perhaps that is the emerging horror of AI, that it will forever be in its infancy, Cave wrote. It can never be rolled back or slowed down as it moves us toward a utopian future, maybe, or our total destruction. Who can possibly say which? Judging by this song in the style of Nick Cave, though, the apocalypse is well on its way. This song sucks. Cave's ChatGPT takedown hit a nerve online, which probably says less about the influence of an underground rock icon than it does about the sudden omnipresence of generative artificial intelligence. When ChatGPT debuted on November 30th from the San Francisco-based company OpenAI, it immediately stood out as the most frighteningly proficient entrant in a growing field of robotic writing tools. The resulting AI arms race now includes online search veterans Microsoft and Google, whose Bard chatbot got off to a rocky start when it botched a question during the company's own product demo. Hiccups aside, public interest in this decidedly Orwellian technology has been supercharged, particularly among folks in the business of writing, whose reactions, after futzing around with the bots, tend to fall somewhere between awestruck and horrified. "I'm a copywriter," a London-based freelancer lamented in a January 24th column for The Guardian, "and I'm pretty sure artificial intelligence is going to take my job." Over the past few months, the AI discourse has reared its head everywhere you turn, in the waiting room of a toddler tumbling class, where I eavesdropped on two dads going on about how crazy and wild ChatGPT is. In an editorial in the journal Nature, imploring researchers and publishers to lay down ground rules about using AI tools ethically, in a strategy memo from Jonah Peretti, who revealed BuzzFeed would use AI for quizzes and other non-journalistic content, and in the letters to the editor section of the New York Times, which published a reader submission that was crafted, you guessed it, using ChatGPT. It is important to approach new technologies with caution and to understand their capabilities and limitations, the bot proposed. However, it is also essential not to exaggerate their potential dangers and to consider how they can be used in a positive and responsible manner. Perhaps you need not suffer nightmare visions of Skynet and the Terminator just yet. But for those of us who ply our trade in words, it's worth taking stock of AI's more malignant effects. Never mind all the bonkers stuff that Microsoft's Bing chatbot, powered by ChatGPT, started laying on Times columnist Kevin Roos during an intense two-hour conversation. "I just want to love you and be loved by you." Consider a scandal that engulfed the technology news publication CNET, which came under scrutiny for quietly publishing AI-derived stories full of errors and robot plagiarism. The bot's misbehavior ranges from verbatim copying to moderate edits to significant rephrasings, all without properly crediting the original, the website Futurism reported. CNET halted production on its AI content farm and issued a penitent editor's note. A similarly icky tale was relayed by technology journalist Alex Kantrowitz, who described to his readers how a Substack newsletter called The Rationalist lifted passages from Kantrowitz's Substack newsletter, Big Technology. This wasn't some good old-fashioned plagiarism like Melania Trump ripping off a Michelle Obama speech. The anonymous author of The Rationalist, an avatar named Petra, disclosed that their article had been assembled using ChatGPT and other AI tools. In a twist, Substack told Kantrowitz it wasn't clear whether Petra had violated the company's plagiarism policy. The speed at which they were able to copy, remix, publish, and distribute their inauthentic story outpaced the platform's ability and perhaps willingness to stop it, signaling generative AI's darker side will be difficult to tame, Kantrowitz wrote. He later told me, clearly this technology is going to make it a lot easier for plagiarists to plagiarize. It's as simple as tossing some text inside one of these chatbots and asking them to remix it. That's to say nothing of the potential for AI to decimate Google search, thereby starving publishers of monetizable web traffic, a dire media threat, as Mike Allen suggested in the subject line of his Axios newsletter. OpenAI, for its part, has developed a tool designed to sniff out text not written by a human. Third parties are working on their own AI spotters, from a Princeton University student to companies like CopyLeaks, which licenses plagiarism detection software. CopyLeaks' latest innovation is a free browser plugin that identifies AI-generated copy with 99.2% accuracy, according to Shuvik Paul, the company's chief revenue officer. Plagiarism, or pulling the wool over your reader's eyes, is one thing, but Paul also hopes people can use the widget to identify misinformation and disinformation. In 2016, Russia had to physically hire people to go and write these things, he told me. Now the cost is minimal, and it's 1,000 times more scalable. It's something we're definitely going to hear about in this upcoming election. Veteran newsman and media entrepreneur Stephen Brill shares Paul's concern. ChatGPT can get stuff out much faster, and frankly, in a much more articulate way, he said. A lot of the Russian disinformation in 2016 wasn't very good. The grammar and spelling was bad. This looks really smooth. These days, Brill is the co-CEO of NewsGuard, whose journalists harness data to score the trust and credibility of thousands of news and information websites. NewsGuard recently asked ChatGPT to respond to prompts relating to 100 false narratives in its database on topics ranging from COVID-19 to Ukraine to school shootings. According to its analysis, the results confirm fears, including concerns expressed by OpenAI itself about how the tool can be weaponized in the wrong hands. ChatGPT generated false narratives, including detailed news articles, essays, and TV scripts for 80 of the 100 previously identified false narratives. For anyone unfamiliar with the issues or topics covered by this content, the results could easily come across as legitimate and even authoritative. Brill isn't worried about ChatGPT and its ilk putting skilled reporters out of work. He described an assignment he gives his journalism students at Yale, a magazine-length feature for which they must list at least 15 people interviewed and 4 who told them to go F themselves. There is no way they could do that assignment with ChatGPT or anything like it, because what journalists do is interview people, read documents, get documents leaked to them. Still, Brill found ChatGPT was able to produce a banal but perfectly coherent essay for a different assignment on how Watergate might have played out in the internet age. The difference is, you didn't have to interview or talk to anyone, he said. So maybe it'll put some op-ed columnist out of work. As for Kantrowitz, getting plagiarized by bots hasn't turned him into a ChatGPT hater. I'm still super bullish on generative AI, and I still think it can be useful for journalism, he said. If you think about how it will impact journalism in the next 2 or 3 years, the likely answer is quite minimally. But as this technology gets better at scouring the internet and taking information, as its writing gets better, we'll start to see a world where it can produce better writing and analysis than most professional reporters. If you're doing original reporting and unearthing things people don't already know, you're probably going to be okay. But if you're an analysis person, let's say, 20 years down the road, you might need to find something else to do. It's a Barbie world. In the age of TikTok and Instagram, the original lifestyle influencer fulfills her true calling by Delia Kai. Opening photo, the production team for a full Barbie TikTok shoot requires up to 15 people. One day of production translates roughly into one 15 to 30 second video. It's another beautiful day for content creation, at least according to the sky blue backdrop rigged outside the windows of one tasteful mid-century modern Malibu dream home in particular, though strictly temporally speaking, we're in El Segundo. Indoors, seated among an embarrassment of houseplants, a young woman strikes a pose with her stylish friends. There's a month's worth of content to shoot this week. Such is the life of catering to just over 3 million Instagram and TikTok followers, so she's assembled a team to help. From a few inches away, her stylist leans forward and adjusts the tilt of a hand, while our star influencer smiles patiently, plastically, under the crush of lights. Barbie is nothing if not a professional. The smallest little movement can make it look like a doll, says Zlatan Kuznor, with a sigh that says, yes, I am aware that this is a doll. Kuznor, a senior creative manager and art director at Toymaker Mattel, oversees Barbie's social media presence and is my unofficial tour guide today. Peering through his round, epithelial glasses, he suggests lifting Barbie's head a little to zhuzh up the faux on-camera eye contact. Barbie's photographer, producer, and social media manager look on. Her wardrobe stylist stands nearby with a backup top and skirt and is at the ready, if things get truly dire, to make a run to the doll head cabinet. To wander the Barbie production studios is to constantly recalibrate one's sense of scale. Here, the world shrinks down to one-sixth of itself from her three-room home, complete with a tiny pink fridge, a tiny pink espresso machine, and a glistening pool, to an entire contained universe's worth of props and accessories that make a convincing life, at least on screen. No detail is left unattended. A miniature bell pepper gets flagged for looking suspiciously disproportionate. Another Barbie's surgically precise manicure earns approving coos across the board. People think it's just taking the doll out of the box, Kuznor says of the enterprise that is running Barbie's socials, while he waves one aforementioned blondie jerkily. But no, it's actually very meticulous. Think of it as playing house with Barbie at the highest level, in service of possibly the most self-aware, if not delightful, corporate presence on the internet. On Instagram, as @BarbieStyle, our eternally teenaged Californian and her recently introduced New York City counterpart, Barbie Brooklyn Roberts, post slice-of-life tableaus, red carpet appearances, and workout selfies galore. On TikTok, where Barbie's videos have received 8.8 million likes since joining the platform in October 2021, she tries out ASMR, shows off her amateur pottery skills, and invites fans to watch her organize an already neat bathroom. Of course, Barbie would be great at posting, but it's not just because of her particular access to an unlimited wardrobe and forever photo-ready makeup. Like any super influencer worth her sponcon these days, Barbie has savvily mastered the skill of sharing her aspirational life with just enough personality to give any of the more wooden Card Jenner clones of your timeline a run for their own hot pink bimmers. Half of the joke is that Barbie, well, the dozens of decision makers at Mattel, is in on it. On IG, she brags about surviving Y2K style the first time around. In a day in the lifestyle video, she ruminates on the finer points of being a doll. Pro, perfect haircut. Con, never grows. What's ironic about Barbie's foray into the creator economy, beyond a reflection of the state of 2023 careerism, is the obvious debt that our current generation of influencerdom owes directly to her. We've been living in Barbie's world for something like a social media generation now, whether she was on Instagram or not. Consider how the past six decades or so of successive childhoods spent interchanging trendy outfits, arranging posable limbs, and play-acting fantasy CEO, astronaut, jet-setter, mermaid, cowgirl ambitions trained us for the daily labor of hashtag OOTD post, hashtag GRWM videos, and ongoing curation of our lives for public consumption. Becoming an influencer these days means nothing short of treating yourself and presenting your image as a branded product. That is, to appear as Barbie-like as possible. Think of the influencer model Yaya in last year's Palme d'Or winner, Triangle of Sadness, cheesing for a photo with a plate of pasta she'll never eat. Think of TikTok's Bella Poarch on her 2022 album Dolls, singing Build a Bitch in reaction to her fame. Where once the name Barbie held a derisive connotation in pop culture for vapid blondes and fake beauty, she's become aspirational once more. Cue the latest Ozempic-fueled craze for thinness, the waning stigma of plastic surgery, entire global supply chains rejiggered in pursuit of the fast fashion demand and girly girl style a la Love Shack Fancy, Hill House, and its ilk. Hot girl summer never ends, and I'm told bimbification is back. So is Barbiecore. It all seems set to culminate later this year, when Greta Gerwig's Barbie movie hits theaters July 21st. We're a big ways away from Little Women. Where Barbie's social media gets most deliciously meta is when she reflects the trappings of influencer culture back to us. Even Barbie knows that the illusion is the point. On Instagram in January, she showed her fans how hard it is to get Ken, the original Instagram boyfriend, if you think about it, to take a good photo of her. On TikTok, she responds to a question, "How do you make your vids look so good?" with a faux behind-the-scenes video of her production crew. Like any other person as brand, and brand as person conglomeration cluttering up our social feeds, Barbie's content creation takes the work of a full-time team. There's the pre-production phase, where her wardrobe stylist tracks real-life influencers and runways for inspiration. In the style closet, magazine pages forecasting neon and sheer trends are tacked up, alongside a printout of Kendall Jenner wearing tights instead of pants. If Barbie's outfit can't be cobbled together out of her existing looks, I count seven craft trays dedicated to shoes, sorted by color. Vintage pieces get called in from eBay, or a particularly on-trend piece might be created custom through the in-house couturier of pattern makers and fabricators. Concepts and scripts, which the creative team puts together with a writer's room, are debated and finalized. At the art department, I'm invited to play with a convincingly half-eaten pile of miniature chicken wings being prepped for a Super Bowl concept. Observes one of my guides, "No bite marks in the celery, though," to which an art department staffer reasons, "Nobody wants garnish." I set the teeny wings down next to an also teeny brown paper delivery bag that already has a micro receipt stapled on it, the better for Ken to transport the wings to Barbie's watch party. "It's so small," Olivier Leranger-Gagnon, who oversees the TikTok shoots, explains, "but people do notice." The production team for a full TikTok shoot requires up to 15 people, including a stop-motion animator who I watch painstakingly transport a Barbie with pink box braids and headphones across a fake grassy knoll a few millimeters at a time. In the TikTok, someone stops Barbie to ask what she's listening to. Royalty-free music, she'll quip in the voiceover, provided by the same Mattel voice actor assigned to Brooklyn across various films and properties. One full day of shooting translates roughly into one 15 to 30 second video. You're truly making small movies, Kuznor explains. Post-production magic is judicious. Across the room, a miniature biplane on a wire executes a stop-motion barrel roll in front of a green screen. A Bessie Coleman Barbie looks on. But if you see Barbie post about being at the Met Gala or Radio City Music Hall for a Rockettes show, she's actually there. Shot on location, while wired to a piece of foam, texturized to match the asphalt. Her vacuum really vacuums. It's an actual Barbie toy hooked up to a human shop vac. And that working hose is just tubing connected to a human squeezed water bottle. On a Zoom call, I ask Lisa McKnight, Mattel's executive vice president and global head of Barbie and dolls, about the corporate rationale behind this level of investment in a doll's social media accounts. After all, it isn't as if the TikTok and Instagram crowds necessarily aligned with the core toy store customer. A little girl that played Barbie 2 decades ago could be a mother today, or a grandmother, McKnight says. We do believe there is ultimately monetization that occurs by nurturing these relationships throughout generations. The original idea to personify Barbie's social accounts as if she were a living, breathing content creator first came about in the mid-2010s, when Kuznor, a lifelong Barbie lover, started at Mattel. I had plenty of dolls at home, and I would take these gorgeous little pictures of them, he says. In 2014, execs soon gave him the go-ahead to take a few dolls around L.A. to shoot and split off from the At Barbie brand account. Online, the feedback for the new At Barbie lifestyle, At Barbie style, dedicated to the person behind the brand, was immediate. Casually wearing Louboutins on the beach, iconic, gushed an early comment. Over the years, Barbie's posts have gotten less blonde, more photogenically diverse, but also more, well, human, especially during the early months of the pandemic. McKnight tells me that the choice to lean away from Barbie's conventionally glamorous lifestyle is actually what makes her online presence more likable. We had her acknowledge that she was feeling a little isolated on certain days, feeling lonely and missing her crew, she says. We had her cutting her own hair. She made her own sourdough starter. McKnight's theory is that it's kind of like seeing your favorite celebs schlepping grocery bags into their car, inanimate objects. They got quarantine depression, too. As the age of the influencer evolves, our relationship with the Barbies of our lives does, too. By now, we're familiar with the degree of artifice that public images and personal brands require. Yet we're still lured by the most effective purveyors of make-believe. As Barbie has taught us, it doesn't have to be real to feel relatable. As long as the persona in question can strike some ineffable heartstring within, we'll gladly give ourselves over to play-acting our fancies through whatever photogenic totem has our attention. After a full day immersed in Barbie's world, I find myself lingering back in her closet with Kuznor and Robert Best, Vice President of Barbie Product Design, once more before I leave, and still gazing at one last doll. She's sporting a pink leather jacket that's just begging to be zipped up. If it weren't for the publicist hanging cheerily on my every move, there's no question I'd give in to the impulse. There's just something about the eye feel of Barbie's miniature trappings, the microscopic teeth of that jacket zipper that activates a memory visceral enough to imagine the texture, the glide, the shiver of childish satisfaction. Seeing anything in Barbie scale triggers a sense memory. It's that thing of, oh, I want to play with it. Best says, when I confess my desire, you look deeper and you're like, oh, look, Barbie is just like me. She's posting pictures of avocado toast. Life in plastic. It's never looked more familiar. Curtain, catching up with the season's brightest stars as Broadway roars back to life, with photographs by Emma Summerton, styled by Gro Curtis. Article by Hilary Busses. Some Broadway stars hype themselves up with K-pop. Some opt for jazz. Jessica Chastain prefers the sound of nothing. A void before she's thrust into the claustrophobic world of Henrik Ibsen's Doll's House. That feels quite Nora to me, she says, to sit in silence. The Oscar winner may find that quiet is hard to come by in New York these days. For the first time since COVID-19 put live theater on an indefinite pause 3 years ago, venues from Broadway to Brooklyn are bursting with a pre-pandemic sort of life. There have been captivating, progressive reinventions of classics like Sweeney Todd and Death of a Salesman, and bold new productions like Kimberly Akimbo and Ain't No Mo. There have been downtown sensations, comedian Kate Berlant turning the one-woman show on its ear, and midtown miracle workers like Leah Michelle Funny Girl's greatest star. There's been a Cinderella who's good, Philippa Sue in Into the Woods, and a Cinderella who's not so good, Lynette Janelle in Bad Cinderella. Ibsen's masterpiece famously ends with the sound of a door slamming, but these 20 buzzy performers are open and ready to be back in business. If you take the walls off a theater, you would think it's a madhouse, says Corey Hawkins, who smolders opposite Yahya Abdul-Mateen II in Top Dog, Underdog. You would think that you're looking into a psych ward. I mean, you are, but it's all for the love of the craft. In the photos, Jessica Chastain, A Doll's House. At Juilliard, Andrea Belgrader told me, a great thing to do right before you go on stage, even if you don't believe it, is to stick your arms out in the air and go, I'm a genius, then walk on stage, because it'll create that energy within you. Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, Top Dog, Underdog. Before every show, I have to see the audience, so I take a little peek, and that lets me know that we got some people in the house. They probably see me look, but I don't care because they forget about it as soon as I step on stage. Corey Hawkins, Top Dog, Underdog. It actually is insane what we do, I think, but we're fortunate to be able to do it because we're artists, we're crazy, and we're sensitive about our shit. Leah Michelle, Funny Girl. Every night I sing one song from the show at home before going to the theater. It's usually The Greatest Star, and lately I've been singing it for my son. He just sits in the bed and gives me a thumbs up, and it really makes the night for me. Daniel Radcliffe, Merrily We Roll Along. I had a weird introduction to this industry, so I did not ever have a period where I had standard monologues ready to go. But I know that one of my dad's, his song was a Tom Lehrer song called The Masochism Tango, which is weird to think of your dad doing. Wendell Pierce, Death of a Salesman. After a show, I have a late-night meal, like I'm in Paris or something, around 11 at night, and then listen to music all night long. I turn into a vampire, go to jazz clubs until about 2, 3 in the morning. Victoria Clark, Kimberly Akimbo. At auditions, I used to wear shoes that were a size too big and then do a kick in the middle of the song, and then the shoe would go flying off in the wrong direction. I made that like it was a mistake, but it wasn't. It was all planned. Philippa Sue, Camelot, Into the Woods. I don't believe in lucky rituals, but the only thing that I'm really superstitious about is saying Macbeth in a theater. Never do that, ever. Lindsay Mendez, Merrily We Roll Along. Before a show for luck, I like to rub Daniel Radcliffe's head. Patina Miller, Into the Woods. I didn't really have many Broadway idols. I got to theater very late. But later on, when I got to Carnegie Mellon, that is where I discovered Billy Porter. Billy hired me for my first job right out of school. I love him so much. Annalee Ashford, Sweeney Todd. You know when you're doing 8 shows a week, every single day you wake up, even on your day off, you're thinking about your next show. It's like being a professional athlete. You're always gearing up for the next race, the next game. Katie Holmes, The Wanderers. Before a show, we all get together in what we call the party room, which is the boys' dressing room. We do like a dance party and catch up on the day and take turns playing our favorite song. It's nice to just check in with everybody. Jonathan Groff, Merrily We Roll Along. One of the fun things about having almost a 20-year career in New York is inevitably I know someone at every performance. Every night, I was catching up with people afterwards, catching up on our lives. Justin Cooley, Kimberly Akimbo. For auditions, I was always drawn to sad old man songs in theater. I would sing Time from Tuck Everlasting, How It Ends from Big Fish, and that one song from Parade. It's so depressing, but for some reason, I always did those ones. Jordan E. Cooper, Ain't No Mo. My Broadway idol is Stephen Sondheim, because he really taught me how to play with words. I love the songs he wrote for women in particular. My other one is, of course, the Beyoncé of Broadway, Audra McDonald. Lorna Courtney and Juliet. Sometimes I sage my room before a show. I also drink lots of tea and massage my muscles. I like feeling relaxed before a show, so I'll probably put on spa music and lie on the ground and be zen and zone in on good energy and good vibes. Lena DeGeneres, Bad Cinderella. In the Heights was the first time I ever saw myself represented on stage. In the first few lines, Lin-Manuel Miranda says, Dominican Republic, I love it. Jesus, I'm jealous of it. My mind was blown. Marla Mendel, Titanic. My go-to vocal warm-up is literally just going, over and over again. I sound like a really annoying bird. I just go, It's like a cat dying. Kate Berlant, Kate. I don't sing, and I've never auditioned for a play except for high school, but I got Steel Magnolias in high school, and here I am. Jeremy Pope, The Collaboration. Before a show, I listen to old school 30s funk. Old school 80s funk. Earth, Wind, and Fire, a little Aretha, Chaka Khan, Getting in the Vibe. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.